We actually put it in the hopper, but you can just get on it if you want to.
We can start gathering here. And, well, I want to welcome you all back again. I appreciate those who took time out of your lives to come enjoy another session of this finance committee. It was kind of entertaining having Senator Hand last time. He'd never seen such a boisterous crowd. I said, welcome to the House, where the people, anyway, really talk and really do what they do here. I know in the past the lobbyists were honest with the House and not so honest with the Senate. They would come and just criticize roundly some of our proposals and go to the Senate with a few modest concerns. So I hope you can be honest here with us as we go forward, and we do have our hands full. There's been some lack of clarity about meetings. Just if you know, on this committee, if there could be a meeting, we're going to have one. And we're going to go the full time generally. We have so much work to cover. I wake up thinking about it and the task that's at hand, and it's pretty daunting. Just to give you a, we do have some a draft of rules here, committee rules. I'm not going to read them to you. There's nothing out of the ordinary in them, I don't believe. If you have an objection about anything, come to me individually, or you know, have a press conference or whatever you want to do about those. The pretty much point is we're going to be respectful here. If you have a good idea, you should have thought of it yesterday so we could know about it today. If there's some amendment that you just thought of and it's in process and it's not a stunt and it's really workable, then we'll be flexible about that. But we are about the business. And if you've... it's really still weird being called the chair. This is a shared responsibility, and it's my job to keep the trains running. And to find our way out of this thing. And if I can somehow capture the best out of all of you, then we will see a product at the end that will have plenty of room for partisan celebration and criticism, but lots of good thing for the people we care about, which I think at the end is really what we're trying to accomplish. So I'm not going to read these to you now. Okay. In the minutes, we're not doing those. Mike, you can come sit at the table while I chat a little bit. Mr. Scandrett, do you have friends with you, or is it just you today? Okay. He's representing many friends. Just a little roadmap about what you can expect we're going to go into a lot of detail on a lot of money. Mr. Hoffman said it well. This is fiscal immersion. I think it's productive. And I think the answers about how to manage this budget, and I use the word manage in caps, is yet to be figured out. And there's people at the table in this room, both as members and as staff, and people in the audience who are veterans and even some of the newer ones who will notice things like, why do we do that? Do we still do that? Does that even work? Is there a better way to do it that gets the job done more effectively to serve the people we care about? And there's been a lot of... Mr. Scandrett, who will address us in a little bit, has been around this... as long as anybody, and he's heard a lot of those sentences. But at the time now is for us to actually do that. And the better we do that, the more we'll soft land the programs and the serve the people we care so much about. So today, Mr. Scandrett will be presenting us some ideas. As the first of many of you who come forward, I hope with ideas that you've been utilizing in your clinics, hospitals, care programs, counties, you know, neighborhoods, churches, that actually serve people well and are effective. And we're not going to have a lot of... The testimony that we're going to be focusing on is kind of productive, solution-oriented stuff. There'll be a time for people to bring forward some case studies about challenges, but I think that from knocking on so many doors and being on these committees for so many person years, we're pretty aware of the challenges. And so we're not going to be emphasizing that kind of testimony as much. If you sense we've missed something, I'm happy to have a little bit of time about that. But I'm just nervous about the time, frankly. What I want to do is spend a good deal of time hearing from people across our state, and anybody out of town who wants to come, Please come. We need the business hotels, you know, the airfare and all that. That's kind of good for the economy. So bring your out-of-state friends. But where there's some successes we can talk about. Minnesota is a progressive state in terms of implementing a lot of really cool things. And a lot of them, there's some pilots that have been we paid for and that are underway that show promise. Well, let's export the pilots. Let's export our good practices. And so that's what I want to hear about at the table. And so if I would go to each of you in the audience, in particular, as you represent a group or those of you who are members who know about a certain success someplace in your locale, I would like to spend a lot of time on testimony like that. There'll be bills coming forward, and we'll be hearing lots of bills and amendments and all that as time goes on. In the meantime, we're also going to be dissecting and digging deeper into the programming. For those of you who came last time, we whistle-stopped through the entire DHS budget in 3.5 hours and had some room for talking about some late things, the expansion idea and so on. And so we're going to do, I think, in 5 meetings or 6 meetings, kind of do a little more in-depth focus look. Today we're going to talk about hospitals. Thursday is waivers. Long-term care and waivers is Thursday. Why don't you say it? Okay, so next week we're doing other ones. Okay. And anyways, that's just kind of the... I'm really serious about doing things to engage the audience as well as the audience being people, if we're on TV or not today, but people listening, people engaged. If you can't get to a committee meeting, talk to my Andy is my... Where is Andy? Okay. Anyway, Andy is my CLA. If you make a request, he'll provide you as a public member or a lobbyist or whatever with the handouts you missed. If you remember my work in the division before, we had lots of handouts, and I think that we need to learn together. So, was that right? The notes are. I use pencils a lot, but we have this thing called a website, I guess, a website. And all the handouts are going to be published on there, so you can sit in your house and look at this stuff, too. So is that all I have to do? Or we'll have to pass it. Yeah. I have to sign it. We'll do that later. Anything else about that? Well, anyway, so we're going to spend, a while talking to Mr. Scandrett. He has a bunch of ideas. We can discuss that for a while. And then I want to leave enough time to talk about hospitals and so on about that. So, Mr. Scandrett, welcome to the committee, and thanks for taking the time. And I know you interrupted some time away to come to us to be the first of many hopeful similar high-quality presentations. So welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Michael Scandrett, and I'm with LPAC Alliance, which is an organization that works with the safety net community, and I'll explain that a little bit more as we go. In past lives, I was a legislative staff person with the Senate Council, directed the Minnesota Healthcare Commission, was later the executive director of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans, and I've been working with a number of different bipartisan healthcare coalitions and task forces under governors of three different parties over the years on health care, mental health care, coverage for uninsured children, cost containment, and other topics. And so having kind of hung around long enough, there are some lessons learned from our past efforts, some of which were successful and some not so successful. And so in talking with Representative Abler and Representative Gottwalt earlier about their perspectives on things such as health care reform and the state budget and how to achieve the savings needed, I was suggesting some principles that I thought were supported by people on both sides of the aisle and that might be a good starting point, and Representative Abler invited me to come and present those to the group. So people do have a handout that I'll be working off of, so I'm not going to go through everything in the handout, but to just touch upon the key points. When I talk about safety net community that I work with, I'm referring to a wide range of types of providers. It's hospitals, it's clinics, it's mental health centers, dental providers, it's programs that serve uninsured people and try to provide them with coverage and services. And this includes mostly private sector organizations, but some government organizations as well. But their common feature is that they all serve low-income, elderly, disabled, and otherwise vulnerable populations of people, and many of them are on state health care programs, which is what this committee is going to be wrestling with, is how to provide that care with very limited financial resources. One thing I should just say that there are some people that are served by state programs that have a lot more complicated problems than just needing health care. I mean, there are, of course, people who just need health insurance to cover their expenses if they're unable to pay for them themselves. But people in poverty often have other complications such as mental illness, homelessness, lack of transportation, or other barriers. And a lot of the organizations that are in the safety net committee that serve people on state programs have developed special expertise to do that. They may provide transportation, they may do outreach and try to reach people in their communities. They try to address the mental health problems as well as other medical problems that people have. So there's been kind of a special type of service that's developed over the years to meet those more complicated needs of some people that are in not only poverty but of other challenges that are they're facing. And to explain that a little bit more, too, is that we sometimes think about the people who are enrolled in state health care programs as just being poor people that need health care. But a lot of the people who are on the programs are poor because of their health problems, and people's lives ebb and flow, and their conditions ebb and flow. And when things happen to people, and they get serious illnesses, they lose their jobs. And when they lose their jobs, they lose their health insurance, but they still have their health care needs. And a big priority of the safety net community is to try to get those people healthy and back to work, and able to get their health coverage through their employment.
Mr. Grant, I just want to interrupt you. There's a group of students in the back. I just want to acknowledge Stillwater. Is that where they're from? And want to welcome you. This is the government actually belongs to you, so look after it well. It's good you can come watch. Maybe one of you will be sitting down here one day, and then you'll know what you're getting into. So thanks for visiting us. So, oh, yeah. And what you're hearing down here is one of Minnesota's health experts. So that's what you're listening to if you're curious what you've walked in on. So, Mr. Skandret, proceed, will you please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just finally, how is the safety net funded? The safety net obviously gets health insurance payments, both private insurance and public health insurance payments for the treatment they provide. But they also generally will collect from the patients whatever they can afford according to a sliding fee, asking patients to contribute to the cost of care. Of course, also trying to raise money through foundations and through charitable support, and kind of patching together whatever funding they can get in order to continue to serve people, and including serving people who are uninsured, so they don't give any payment for them other than whatever they can afford to pay themselves. And so they obviously need to raise more money than just what they can get through insurance. So kind of to wrap that up, there's kind of two major purposes of the safety net. One is providing that specialized kind of services that are more effective with certain groups of people who have complicated needs, need more than just health care. And then secondly, serving as the last resort or the safety net for people that don't have anywhere else they can go to get health care they need. So both a center of excellence and a safety net last resort for people. I'm sure you can understand, the safety net system has been hit pretty hard because of the recession, and then also as a result of the government budget crisis. More people are uninsured because they've lost their jobs or because their employers aren't able to continue to provide them with health insurance or they can't afford the cost themselves. And with the rising cost of health care, often can't pay for the care themselves. So more people are going to clinics and hospitals, especially those that are that concentrate on serving uninsured and low-income populations. So they're seeing more patients, many of whom are not insured. But the second part of that is the payments for any provider or health plan that's serving people have been cut back because of the budget crisis. So they're not only losing payment for some people who don't have insurance, but they're also receiving less for those that still have insurance through the state. And then the final is that the economy has affected everyone, and charitable donations and foundation grants have also gone down. So those providers that have been in place to try to be that last resort and provide those specialized services are having a very difficult time as a result of the recession. I think everybody here knows, some of you more painfully than others, that the legislature has been through several years now of budget cuts, and so provider rates have been cut, eligibility and benefits have been cut, programs have been downsized substantially. And it's come to the point where the traditional way of getting savings is probably not going to work without losing major parts of the system to being unable to survive financially. And so we don't believe that the traditional approaches will work, but we recognize that the state does need to cut substantially, and that's a given coming out of session. So what we think needs to happen is to think of different ways to provide the services rather than to continue to make the kind of piecemeal cuts in the existing system that we have. So what I'm going to be walking through quickly today is just some suggested principles that are based on a lot of work that's been done in Minnesota. And Minnesota is fortunate, it's probably better positioned than most other states to figure out a way to do things differently, how to continue to provide the basic services people need at a lower cost. There's both private sector and public sector efforts underway to get there. It's just a question of how fast can they get there. And the immediate crisis requires maybe a faster pace than most people are comfortable with, but I think people are ready to try to move there as quickly as we can. First principle that is on the handout that you have is to simplify and consolidate state health care programs. And this has become, I think, an almost universal comment from everybody involved in the system, is we've just gotten to the point where there's too many different programs, too many different income standards and asset standards, too many different types of benefits depending on who you are. I didn't bring a big pile of paper for you today because you're probably already been deluged, but the State Department of Human Services does put out a summary of the major state health care programs. And I encourage you to take a look at it sometimes. There's actually 6 different major programs, 16 different categories of eligibility, and 6 different income cutoffs depending on your characteristic. And each of these programs often has different benefits. You get the care through different providers or different health plans, and there's a different level of service that's available to you. So this has become the point where it's very difficult for anybody to understand the current system. If this can be simplified and streamlined and even get to the point where people could apply online, because the application process is even worse than the IRS system for filing taxes, it's very difficult for people, especially when you're thinking of the populations being served here. So I think it would be benefit everyone and reduce administrative costs and make the programs more efficient and accountable if we could get to a simpler system. The second concept is really, I hit two of them together. It's really that we've gotten to the point where, in this committee in particular, is going to, again, experience a lot of pain. Some of you have already, when you get the state budget documents that comes from the governor that lists all the line items in the budget. It's many, many, many pages of very small print and many lines of funding. And, again, it becomes very difficult to figure out how to hold someone accountable for providing efficient services to someone if it's all broken into hundreds of different programs and funding line items and with different requirements for each. So it would be positive to try to figure out how a lot of those services could be bundled together. And managed care is an example of how this has been done, and it has had success in terms of holding a single entity accountable for a fixed budget and being responsible for providing the care people need within that that budget. The financial incentives that go along with a fixed budget can be very powerful, and the General Assistance Medical Care, or GAMC, program from last year is a good example of both what can be good and bad about bundling and about creating payment incentives for providers to be more efficient. I think that the silver lining of GAMC was that as a result of the significant cut in payments, and delivering the money to one entity or four entities that were eligible to receive it. There were things done to become more efficient, to get people into better health, to keep them in the community and avoid the emergency room and inpatient hospital services. The problem was the money was cut so deeply that it resulted in a lot of unfortunate things happening, such as it was very hospital-based, so often people who had existing doctors or clinics, outpatient clinics they were attending, were forced to switch to a different doctor and lost the coverage for that outpatient care that they would have had otherwise. Also, many parts of the state, probably many of you at the table are familiar with the really losing that coverage option for people in your community, with a lot of the resources being concentrated in the metropolitan area. The fourth principle is focusing on outcomes, not the process or volume of services provided. And maybe 10 or 20 years ago, it would not really have been possible to do this effectively in healthcare. But as a result of work that's been done in the past, such as the Minnesota Community Measurement Program, and if you don't know about that, it would be important for you to learn about it. It's a place where you can go to look at the quality performance of various clinics across the state. So you can look up your clinic where you get your care and see how they do on different measures of quality. Yes.
Mr. Scandrett, you've attracted a question. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Scandrett, thank you. I would like to go back to point number three about the fixed budget for bundled services and go back to our experience with the GAMC triage as implemented. One of the things that I noted as I talked with providers across the state over the course of the summer was the fix as implemented really did cut out whole chunks of providers. So, for instance, dentists weren't covered, primary care providers weren't covered, but I think the most vexing of issues that I heard about was physicians who are not employed by hospitals, their services weren't covered. And I met with a group of ophthalmologists, and you know, they're bound to some extent by Rule 101, and they wanted to know what our expectation as policymakers were when they were presented with a patient who didn't have coverage under GAMC or any other mechanism had a detached retina, which is an emergency situation, which would result in blindness if not fixed. Do you have advice for us on a situation like that as you talk about fixed total budgets for bundled services?
Yep, and I agree, Representative Murphy, that what happened under GAMC is that it was cut so deeply on the one hand that there wasn't even enough money to provide very basic services, so that created some serious problems. I think it ended up being about 12 to 15 cents on the dollar for the program. But the other part, so it was very hospital-based. It did not really focus on the kind of outpatient services. It wasn't a statewide strategy that worked very well. So it really is a good example of things to avoid in these kind of strategies in the future. But it also does illustrate that incentives can bring about changes. I think part of the problem was GAMC, among all the programs, was singled out for much larger cuts. And had the cuts been, distributed more across programs, it might have been easier to achieve a better outcome than taking such deep cuts off of GAMC alone. And the other switch I'll mention later that we did see happening because of GAMC is just because, the state was not paying for that any longer didn't mean that the costs and the needs went away, and often it is local governments or it's private providers that end up providing the care free, and even with private providers, they're going to have to charge more to their other customers, so the cost for all of us goes up if they're having to treat people that are not covered any longer.
Representative Murphy, is that good enough? And we'll just all comment, too. I think part of it is certainly the funding was extremely lean on that whole program, but I think there were some great successes in what was learned about how to coordinate these very challenging populations, and I think maybe part of the answer is maybe a hospital-based system isn't the best one to do, or at least there's a place for that and a place for a safety net clinic based one. And so I think that hopefully I plan to look into some of this later, and so if we can learn from the good parts about this and preserve that as we look to an expansion. If we don't, you'll discover in the Minnesota Care budget that we're $150 million light, and those same kind of costs are going to continue through the medical assistance system as well. So I think it's productive, and I think it's a, thanks for the question. Continue on, Mr.
All right. Andrew. Well, I'll move on to number four, which is focusing on outcomes, not process or volume. And as I said, we now have much better ways of measuring quality than we ever have had before. And that makes it possible to move away from regulating or measuring performance based on how many services you provide or how much money you spent, but instead look at, did the person get better? Was it a good outcome or not a good outcome? And so kind of the picture here is if you can bundle the money together, if you can then focus on the outcomes, then you are able to be a lot less regulatory of the particular ways in which the organizations are going to achieve that goal. I think in some ways this is kind of a mixed bag because at the same time that it's important to focus on outcomes and we need some information to measure outcomes, I think the state has gone a little overboard in terms of the amount of information and reports that are collected from people that receive public dollars. And I'll kind of jump ahead a little bit now, but for example, the one type of health plan that serves people on government programs are called county-based purchasing plans, and they're health plans serving people on state programs that are a local in rural communities. They're created by collections of counties and provide health coverage for people. And they did a kind of analysis of all the reports that are required by government as a condition for them to provide services. They reached a grand total of 1,000 reports each year from four different agencies, a federal CMS agency, the State Department of Human Services, the State Department of Commerce, and the Minnesota Department of Health. And when you're acquiring 1,000 reports, there are people whose full-time job is to just generate reports. And also, for those that you want to get into the agonizing detail of this, we have them all listed and described. And you'll see that there are a lot of redundancy in the reports where multiple state agencies may be collecting the same information, or the state federal, multiple state and the federal agency collecting the same information, and that a lot of the reports, we believe, are never used. They're collected and cost money to collect, but they really don't drive either the regulatory functions or the policy making that's done at the state level. So we would suggest that there are ways to hold organizations accountable for their results without having to be so prescriptive and require so many required reports to provide the information that's needed to measure accountability.
And Mr. Scandrett, I just want to kind of echo that. And part of, you know, there's a term, lean engineering. Most of our DHS programs are not leanly engineered with a clear focus and a clear outcomes. And some of the measurements we put in place are layered upon old reports that somebody thought was a good idea. So, and I think you're doing a great job on the global stuff here, but in terms of specifics, I need to hear from the county-based purchasing groups and from the health plans and other people about what reports they think are extraneous. Well, if a hearing on those, we'll let somebody who thinks they're a good idea say why we should keep them. But I think in the bill that will be coming out of this committee in a couple of months is going to have some significant undoing of some of these valueless kinds of procedures that are in place. We have no choice. If we don't do that, we're going to have to do something else that we'll like even less. And so we want to keep the protections and the accountability, but not just for its own name's sake. So, if anybody wants to interrupt on along his points to pile onto those, this is the purpose of today's meeting, and we'll be discussing many of these same things again in different iterations. So I guess you can continue. Representative Mack.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question on those 1,000 reports. I just wanted to clarify what percent of those could the state legislature impact, and what percent is it the federal government imposing those that we wouldn't be able to affect?
That's an excellent question, Representative. And we can give you more detail if you'd like it, but of the total, about 19% are federal requirements by the CMS agency. Less than 1% are from the Department of Commerce, about 10% are from the Department of Health, and 70% are from the Department of Human Services. So all but that 19% would be something that the state legislature could do something about.
Well, keep going. Thanks.
All right, so we've talked about outcomes. Competition is also something that people have been working to try to create a better way for competition to occur in healthcare. And it's something we need to continue to work on. But in order to do that, there does have to be the flexibility to allow organizations to innovate to achieve the results that you want to achieve in different ways. So we need competition that doesn't just compete between old models and existing models, but competes with new models that might be better than the ones we currently have. And also models that can work in every area, because I think people know that competition in rural areas takes very different forms than competition in the metro area. You're not going to have many different provider networks to choose from in a rural area. You know who your providers are. You have a different type of relationship with them in rural communities. And so when you think about competition, that really isn't as relevant to people in rural areas as it is to people that live in large cities where there are many different providers to choose from. Also, that competition should enable those specialized types of independent providers that may be particularly good at serving certain populations to exist as well. We can't go to a generic average that maybe serves the average, whoever that might be, person well, but doesn't serve those that have unique needs. So there has to be a place for, within competition, for people to get personally tailored services that meet their needs and still achieve the state's outcomes, goals, and cost containment limits. Number six is becoming very important to really the people that are served, as well as the organizations that make up the safety net community. And that's really about giving consumers more choices and control. I think people feel like that the system is driven by the program requirements, and it's driven by funding decisions, but often people aren't able to get what they need or go to the provider that they prefer, or to be able to have control of their health care as much as they would like to. And this doesn't say that you write a blank check or that people should be able to get anything regardless of the implications for themselves or others. But I think we can count on consumers to be a part of deciding, if we have to cut spending, what are our priorities for preserving services, and how can we have a system that's going to be serve the individuals as best it can with the resources we have, rather than serving the providers and organizations and government that are there to provide that service to people. Number seven is reducing state regulations and mandates, and I jumped ahead to give you a little bit of the data that's there, but there's another example too, and that is, if you think of the state's community health centers, which, if you don't know about them yet, they're a special type of primary care health care provider that specializes in serving low-income and vulnerable populations. And a lot of the new concepts that are coming out today, if you hadn't heard them yet, you will be, like healthcare homes and accountable care organizations and coordinated care delivery systems. The community health centers have been doing this for people for a long time, because when you have an uninsured patient that has no coverage and no money, you're going to do everything you can to be as efficient as you can in serving them and try to keep them out of the hospital, because there's no way to pay for that hospital care. And so they were, long before others were thinking about it, were trying to figure out how to serve that individual's needs in the way that's going to keep them as healthy as possible. And yet when this became a more popular concept with the legislature and in the marketplace, the idea of a healthcare home developed, and it became something that the state wanted to certify. And as a result is a long list of requirements that you had to meet in order to become certified as a healthcare home. And the irony is that a lot of the community health centers have chosen not to become certified, because the costs of meeting the regulatory requirements are greater than any benefit they would get out of becoming certified as healthcare homes. So if the models and the best examples of healthcare homes are not able to be regulated under the system, we should look again at whether we're asking for the right things. And if we focused on the outcomes rather than that process, many of the community health centers have the highest quality scores in the state, even though they serve some of the most difficult populations. So they're able to kind of keep their costs down, meet the needs, keep the patients as healthy as possible, and provide high-quality care. it would think, and plus having to meet a lot of federal requirements as a condition of being community health centers, it would not seem like we would need to add so many requirements at the state level for them. Principle 8 is allowing greater flexibility and local control. I think everybody around this table especially knows that every community is different, and you have different health care systems, you have different perspectives, you have different ways of relating to each other. And we need to have an opportunity for local communities to have a greater ability to determine how health care is delivered and provided, especially government health care programs in those communities. And I'm talking primarily about geographic communities, and especially rural communities, but it also applies to other types of communities. That's groups of people that might have a common interest, such as people with a physical disability, and that those communities, consistent with what I said earlier about consumers having more say, should have an opportunity to weigh in and to control how health care is delivered for them, assuming that, again, that we're able to meet the cost containment requirements and provide quality care. Getting the last one is maintaining the safety net infrastructure, and I use those terms really broadly to refer to both the public and private providers and organizations who do serve the elderly, disabled, vulnerable, and impoverished Minnesotans who need the basic health care. And keeping that system in place is going to require two types of attention. One is making sure that the costs of providing the care for people that are enrolled in health care programs are sufficient for them to be able to cover their costs. And the second is be sure that there is the infrastructure of providers who can meet unique needs of particular populations, even if there's not enough of those populations to generate the traditional revenues to keep that place afloat. And you can think about things such as the burn units at certain hospitals and others where we all want to have those services available, and we need to look at ways to make sure that the funding is there to keep those things going. Got a final note on maintaining the infrastructure, just to point out that we think of the safety net community in many cases as even some private nonprofit providers, and especially in rural communities, the physician group or the dental clinic in rural communities are really part of the safety net. And one of the things that the legislature has done in the past to try to preserve the safety net is to recognize that if one of these private clinics is providing for dental care, for example, to a larger percentage of people that are enrolled in state programs, which, by the way, pay very low rates compared to what they would be getting paid from their insured patients, that there was the state has provided an initial bump in the payment rate to those dental providers to recognize the fact that by being willing to be the safety net in their community, they actually would take a loss that they wouldn't otherwise have. And this doesn't defray it entirely, but the idea of these added payments makes it more possible for them to serve people on the state programs. Unfortunately, after last session, kind of unexpected to a lot of us, the Department of Human Services eliminated that eligibility of the private dental clinics to get that additional payment. So we, again, very concerned about all the parts of the safety net, not just those that might be nonprofit clinics or community health centers. So, Mr. Chair, that covers the principles, and I'd be happy to answer any questions that you might have.
Well, thanks, and I guess we have quite a bit of things to talk about today, but I really appreciate what you've given us here, and if you're getting a theme of anything I'm doing to you as members, I'm giving you thoughts to go home with and to ruminate on. And as you learn about more about, especially to the freshmen who are here, but to us veterans, it's nice to have a set of things to look at while you look at what we're doing, you know, and more just than the simplistic ones. And so I think you've been very helpful to us, Mr. Scandrett. And I know you'll be back later as we, and I know if you are, I believe you've offered if people would like to, they could chat with you and you would come and enlighten them on some of these matters. So are there any questions? Okay, thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, thank you. And we'd be happy to provide information. And then you can also expect that we'll be bringing a lot of more specific proposals that are consistent with the principles as suggestions for you to consider.
Thank you very much. And maybe the hospital team can come down now. Oh, alone? Okay. Okay, there's some follow-up from last week's questions here. You can read about more homework. Rep. Murphy, did you want to?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you know, I appreciate the principles. The first principle, the simplify and consolidate state health programs, is something that, you know, we've been working at in the past couple of years and really hit a speed bump, if you will, a brick wall with the former administration. So I guess I'm curious to know, as the chair, if you are open to these ideas as we move forward, if we were to bring legislation forward.
Well, I appreciate you asking. I tried calling the governor's office this morning, and it's a whole different phone number now. So they're purging any reference to the previous administration. In fact, I think they'll still have the portrait. But anyway, so I'll take your question at face value. I am open to any idea that makes sense, that serves people as well or better, and that helps us match the revenues to the costs. And I'm absolutely open to those ideas. Ms. Krinke, do you want to come down? So I hope that's clear enough, and I'm not sure what I've agreed to. I have teenagers, and, you know. Well, Dad, can we go? Like, oh, why not? You know. Well,
Mr. Chair, I'm not a teenager.
Okay. Oh, it was a compliment. Oh, I thought you were. So shocked. The next part of this, I'm not sure if we'll get the dish today. And if we don't, we'll pick that up. But I wanted to have a pretty in-depth discussion about different aspects. And Ms. Krinke, look who I invited first. I mean, just want you to know who loves you. So there's going to be a series of small groups set up. One of them is going to involve hospitals. And I've asked Representative Kiffmeyer to lead up that effort. And I'll be chatting between Representative Huntley and, I know, Representative Liebling, whoever can help, see if some of your members would like to participate there. And I haven't decided how to ask you all, and we are working on a list of, it's going to involve waivers, do we have a list of six? There's six anyway, hospitals, waivers, healthcare, remember the six? Child care, welfare, well, long-term care. And so we're still kind of figuring out how to drive all this, but I absolutely want to engage those who choose to engage in ways, and what that'll look like from the administrative point of view would be that there'd be administrative support, getting stuff from the departments, finding who the lobbyists are, meetings with the small numbers of you. They would be, I would think, groups of two or three, so there's no quorum issues. This is going to be work. There's not going to be public meetings. You can have one if you want. We can facilitate that if lobbyists don't like meetings today. Anyway, but so meetings if you want to have some discussions and within reason. And anyway, so with that in mind, I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Kiffmeyer, who will then preside over this discussion, and then we'll come back when she's all done and dismiss you. So, Representative Kiffmeyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Ms. Krinke, I'm very pleased to have you at the committee today, and a subject near and dear to my heart, so glad to have your presentations and your proposals. So with that, if you would just like to go ahead and proceed, and if there's any materials that you're going to be using, if you would just reference them and make sure that the committee members are on that page with you as you get started.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. Thank you, Chairman Abler, for this opportunity to meet some of the new committee members and to have this chance to share some background information on hospital financing. I noticed later on in the agenda, Paul Olson from the department is going to get into some of the real technical, whenever you get into intergovernmental transfers and DSH payments, that stands for disproportionate share hospital payments, you're into some of the what I call real technical aspects of hospital financing. And I thought it might be helpful to at least start out with a broader, bigger picture before we kind of jump down into some of the more specific details. So with that, the first thing I'd like to start out with is to think about that this really is about health care and about saving lives. I read a statistics in the Science Daily that I wanted to share with you. In 1970, if you made it to 65 years of age, you had a 20% chance of making it to age 85. Fast forward to your 2005. If you make it to age 65, you now have a 40% chance of making it to age 85. So we have, in essence, in the last 25 years, really added life expectancy to our citizens in this country. And all this talk of money and who's providing what, I just don't think we can lose sight of the fact that we have outstanding health care delivery in this country, and we are extending life expectancy. So I just, as we talk about all this, we have to always keep that in the back of our minds, and it is important. The bad news in this report, it doesn't say that those years are all disease-free. We are, and I am guilty of this as well, we are all older, we are all fatter, and we are all sicker. So that means that some of us here in this room, myself maybe included, we might be on medications for hypertension, high blood pressure, high cholesterol. We are not living necessarily without diseases, and that means that we are adding to our healthcare costs. So I do think we have to recognize that we're probably going to spend more on healthcare than we did before. With that, I think it's also, I know everyone in this room is concerned about jobs, economic growth, and the sustainability. I think our old view was always that healthcare was a drain on our economy. I think we need to rethink that. Healthcare is actually one of Minnesota's economic engines. Tom Stinson in the last report said one of the things that helped us through this last recession was agriculture and healthcare, and that they were the two bright spots of our economy. So I would like, and sometimes I've heard both sides of the political aisle say that healthcare is such a drain on our economy. And I would like to challenge this committee to never use those words again, that healthcare is not a drain on our economy, it is an asset to our economy. We at the Minnesota Hospital Association just asked the Department of Employment and Economic Development to do an analysis of what hospitals contribute to the Minnesota economy. And we knew that it was a lot, but it was actually much more than we had ever anticipated. In terms of direct jobs that hospitals provide, we employ over 113,000 people here in Minnesota. The indirect impact of that is over 100,000 jobs related to hospital employment. You look at then the wages and salaries, and then they have a multiplier that they use at the department to calculate how much is then purchased by hospitals in local goods and services, whether it be dietary for the cafeterias, whether it be laundry. I mean, you go throughout every aspect of a hospital and you look at all the purchases they make, and then they calculate a multiplier effect. And it's estimated that the hospitals in Minnesota contribute over $27 billion, that's with a B, to our state economy. This is a breakdown of what that means in terms of salaries, jobs, and economic impact. This is just a little color chart breaking it down. The next chart I wanted to share with you is thinking about our own state budget. And this is from the Management of Budget Office. And I have a chart, a pie chart from 10-11 and one from 12-13 as well. And if you look at Health and Human Services for 10-11, Health and Human Services is 29% of the state budget. K through 12 education is 37.3. Now let's look at the chart from 12-13. Health and Human Services is 30.9 and K through 12 is 40.5. And I know my next few statements here are not going to make me the most popular person in the room, but that's okay. The Health and Human Services budget is expected to grow by 6.5%. The K through 12 budget is expected to grow by 8.5%. Now, I know that we have all heard that Health and Human Services is the fastest growing part of the budget. And when you look at these pie charts, I don't think that that's the case. Now, it's also probably due to a bump in enrollment in our K through 12 schools. I'm not trying to place a value judgment on this. This could be increasing class sizes and enrollment. But it isn't just important to look at historically. If we go back 20 years and look at Minnesota's state budget, we have spent about a third of our state budget on Health and Human Services, and we have spent about 40% of our state budget on K through 12. I venture to say if we had a crystal ball and could look into the future, that we would probably spend 70 to 75% of our state budget on health and human services and K through 12 education in 10 years from now. They are the two most important parts of our budget. They're the biggest parts of our budget. And I don't think those numbers are going to dramatically change. So I just want to put that in perspective for you all. Also, I think it's important to note that every dollar that's in the Medicaid program has a dollar of federal match. This was true before the passage of the federal health care reform bill. This is our ongoing Medicaid program, nursing homes, disability programs, hospitals. Everything has a dollar match in the Medicaid program. So when you think of the challenges that you have for this committee, and let's just say Chairman Abler is given a target of $1 billion, that means that the impact to the providers and the patients that we serve and other folks throughout the Health and Human Services budget, that means it would be a $2 billion impact if you all have to cut $1 billion. So you cannot take your work lightly here in this committee. That's a lot of money that you all may be challenged to come up with. So I just want you, when you're talking with your colleagues who aren't on this committee, be ever mindful of whatever target you set for this committee, it is probably going to have double the impact. So it's just, you got to lobby your colleagues to help protect the budget in this division. Just looking at, I want to move forward now more specifically on hospital financing instead of less general. This is a map that just shows where the hospitals in Minnesota are located. The hospitals in Minnesota are all nonprofit. They're not required to be so by law. They just are. I do think that that has made Minnesota healthcare delivery better. It means that when we do have a positive margin, we plow those margins back into our community, providing services. We don't have shareholders. We don't pay dividends. We use our resources to provide community services. And that's just a chart of where the hospitals are located. We have 54 hospitals that are publicly owned, either by city, county, or district. We have 59 hospitals with attached nursing homes. So I know in rural Minnesota, a lot of the hospitals and nursing homes are shared ownership and provide services among a continuum back and forth. We have 79 hospitals that are critical access hospitals. This is a designation by the federal government requirement that the hospital have less than 25 beds and be more than 30 miles away from another hospital. They are also paid their costs within the Medicare program, which is extremely important for rural hospitals, given that Medicare may be 60% of their patient caseload. I have a pie chart here coming up that shows the breakdown of payer sources, but just knowing for our rural hospitals that most of their patients are on Medicare, that really is very important. About 600,000 inpatient visits a year. The top reasons are birth, mental health, orthopedic procedures, and digestive disorders. About 1.66 million emergency room visits and about 9 million outpatient visits. I do think it's interesting that the amount of inpatient visits has been constant from last year. We are doing a better job of moving more services to be provided on an outpatient basis. The outpatient number is growing. So if you stop and think about how providers are trying to hold down costs in our healthcare delivery system, the more services that we can provide on an outpatient basis instead of an inpatient basis, it does help reduce our overall costs. Minnesota rankings, and this is also important that you should know that our hospitals in Minnesota are some of the best in the country. We are providing quality care, safe care, and we have gotten a number of awards and recognitions for our quality, safe care. On January 20th, the Minnesota Department of Health will be releasing the 8th Annual Adverse Health Event Report. Minnesota was the first state in the nation to publicly report our mistakes and errors, and it's a sad day for us at the Minnesota Hospital Association when we have to publicly talk about our errors and mistakes. But everybody needs to know that we are committed to improving on that, and we share that information with our members. We do a root cause analysis, and we try to get to the bottom of what caused those mistakes and errors. And it is part of our transparency effort and part of our ongoing quality improvement. We have three websites that ask you all to look at your leisure, not now obviously. We have a hospital quality report in which we report every hospital in the state provides us with information on these quality measures. You can look up how your hospital is doing on heart attack, heart failure, pneumonia, infection prevention, and surgical care. And you can log on and you can see what quality measures they are reporting in each of those. We also have a price check. You can go online and see prices for over 50 services and compare your prices at your local hospital to another hospital. And we also do an annual community benefit report. Now let's get into hospital financing. Basically, there are four programs that are government programs. Medicare, which is a program, as you all know, paid for by the federal government. You must be 65 years of age to qualify. It is not means tested. You can be Bill Gates' father and still qualify for Medicare. There's Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and General Assistance Medical Care. This is the payer mix chart, and I do think it's key to mention that this is an average for all the hospitals in the state. So you're going to have some hospitals that have higher Medicare patients, and you're going to have other hospitals that have higher volumes of Medicaid, Minnesota Care, and GAMC. And for example, Children's Hospital has a huge volume of Medicaid kids, and their Medicaid population census is probably 40%. Obviously, Children's Services, they don't have as many patients on Medicare, don't have any patients on Medicare. But so this just gives you a breakdown of the payer mix for hospitals. The next slide I want to share with you all is a formula that I think could come in handy all year long as you're looking at budgets and different groups that come in and present. Cost equals price times volume times services. And everything you see on your spreadsheets and when you get the numbers, that's the cost that the state pays. That's what the state and that's what you're trying to deal with. The P is the price. That's what the provider receives for the services that they have already rendered. And I can't express to you, hospitals take care of folks when they come in. We figure out the payment later. So it is the price is what the government pays us. The volume is the number of people that are enrolled and served in the program. So what has happened over the course of the last few years with this recession, it is not that hospitals or physicians or other providers are getting paid more. That P, that price, has actually gone down. What has happened is that the volume of individuals with this recession who need healthcare services has increased. So your costs to the state have increased, but it's not because providers are getting paid more. It's because of the volume of the people we are serving. And the last multiplier there is service level, severity. And that goes back to my little joke about being older, fatter, and sicker. If we can keep people healthier, we do have a way to try to reduce the severity of the services that they are incurring. This is just a breakdown specifically of hospital payments within the medical assistance program. This was taken from the forecast, so if you want to go back and look at these numbers, this is a projection of what hospitals' estimated percentage of the Medicaid budget is. And I know there's a tendency, because hospitals are big buildings and we do employ a lot of people, to think that hospitals are a big portion of the Medicaid budget. We're about 15%. That includes our inpatient hospital fee-for-service payments, the outpatient hospital fee-for-service payments, as well as our percentage of the PMAP program. That's the amount that has been paid to the health plans for folks enrolled in a capitated Medicaid product. And hospitals are about 26% of that. So the overall percentage that is the hospital portion is about 15 to 16% for 12-13. I know that later on you're going to be hearing a little bit more about how medical assistance rates are established, but I want to go back a little bit in time here. There was a United States Senator named David Boren from Oklahoma who got in federal legislation that hospitals and nursing homes had to receive payment adjustments act to ensure that nursing homes and hospitals were, quote, reasonably and adequately paid to meet costs. And that provision was repealed in 1997. While that was probably good news for state budgets around the country for their Medicaid budgets, it did create a situation for nursing homes and hospitals where they were no longer guaranteed that the Medicaid program would pay them their costs. So what we have now is a situation where the Medicaid program pays us substantially below our costs. In Minnesota,
Ms. Krinke?
Yes.
Excuse me. I just want to mention we have three other presenters, and you're giving some very, very good information. I appreciate it. But we're going to have to wrap this up here, and we can just focus on that. And then also we want, just in case there's a question yet, too.
Perfect.
Thank you.
I will move more quickly. We do have in Minnesota a rebasing process where the rates were supposed to be adjusted every 2 years. That has been canceled in 2009 and in 2011. This next chart just shows a history of the rate cuts that have been in place. We are now paid in the hospital program at our 2002 costs, minus 14.4%. There will be an additional cut that goes into effect July 1 of this summer. So you all have already cut hospital rates moving forward here. So starting this July, hospitals will be paid at 16% below our 2002 costs. Hospitals are very reliant on cross-subsidization and cost-shifting. We have some services within a hospital that do have a positive margin, and they help us pay for services that lose money, like mental health delivery, chemical dependency, and others. Cost-shifting to the private sector, I'm sure you've heard from your local businesses, it's estimated that it's about 15 to 20% of private premiums that cost-shifting. One key thing I do need to mention is EMTALA, the Emergency Medical Treatment and Active Labor Act. Hospitals are required by federal law to provide emergency services regardless of an individual's ability to pay. And other healthcare providers, while they do provide charity care, they're not obligated by law to do so. Michael Scandrett did a good job of outlining the impact of the recession to healthcare providers. I think you all know that we've seen reduced volumes. Cuts have had to be made. And in Minnesota, we have more health insurance plans that have HSAs and a lot of folks who can't pay their upfront copay or deductible. We have a number of hospitals that are operating at a loss and minimum margins. This is a chart showing the growth in uncompensated care. I'm sure your local hospitals have talked to you all about that as well. Chairman Abler, a couple years ago, I had a chart for you that you had some concerns about, because we had some hospitals that were reporting based on charges and other hospitals that were reporting based on costs. This has now all been audited by the Department of Health, and it is all based on costs to the hospital. So the numbers are actually reduced from when you saw it, and it was based on charges. This is all based entirely on a hospital cost now.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Madam Chair, Ms. Krinke, thank you.
Okay. Just two more slides. In terms of payment for supporting the healthcare infrastructure, I know a lot of people know about the provider tax. Hospitals pay the 2% provider tax, which is about $184 million a year, but we also pay a Medicaid surcharge of 1.56% on all revenue except for Medicare, and that generates about $119 million. Last slide. I talk fast. This one I know is really hard to see, but it is the last impression I want to leave you all with, and that is paying for value. On the one side, the vertical axis is cost, and on the bottom axis is quality. This is a national comparison where you can see that Minnesota, in terms of our costs, is toward the bottom down there with South Dakota, North Dakota, Iowa. And then if you look at the far right, you'll see the states that are delivering the best quality in healthcare: New Hampshire, Wisconsin, Maine, and Minnesota. So the best place to be in this chart is in the bottom quadrant, the lower right-hand quadrant, which means you are providing healthcare services at a low cost and high value. So I think in our deliberations, your deliberations, think about maintaining Minnesota's high quality and low cost delivery. So thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Excellent presentation. And a lot of good information. We really appreciate your taking the time to prepare this and present it, especially closing quickly. If there are any questions from the members of the committee at this time?
Thank you, members of the committee, and I'm around a lot over here. I know I went through that pretty quickly, so if you have questions, I'll be around. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Krinke. Okay, the next presenter we have at this time is Paul Olson, manager of the payment policy from the Department of Human Services. Mr. Olson, if you would please come forward. Welcome, Mr. Olson.
Thank you.
Would you please introduce yourself for the record? And do you have any materials today? If you would just lift them up or let us know what they are so we can be with you, especially out of respect for some of our freshmen.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Olson. I work with the Department of Human Services for many, many years. In the hospital payment systems, today I'll talk about inpatient hospital payment. We have a handout that says at the top of it, MA Inpatient Hospital Payment Summary, Payment System Summary. I'm also here to talk later about the disproportionate share payments, and that's also a handout. I can do this fairly fast from the summary. I think the summaries are fairly well presented in terms of just, without getting into too much detail, the system itself is mathematically complex, but the policies around it are not complex. I'm here to talk about the fee-for-service inpatient hospital payment system. Fee-for-services are those services that we buy directly as opposed to giving money to a health plan who then buys it for us. So we are, in effect, our own insurer for inpatient. We spend approximately $600 to $700 million a year on these programs, half of which is federal. A little more than half because of the ARRA, but generally speaking, 50%. So it is true that if a dollar is cut, it costs the hospital $2. We always talk in terms of whole rates. The system goes back about 20 years. It's well designed, but it's been hampered fairly financially, fairly much by reductions around the periphery of it. Over the years, we've been allowed to write amendments and stuff, staff and all of us, that would not hit at the direct how it actually works, the design of it, but how to take money out without going directly at it. It's based on medical assistance specific data. The rates are and the payments are. It's based on hospital specific data, which is kind of old fashioned now. This law was written in about 1990, I believe we wrote most of it. It's a payment per admission with a DRG, diagnosis adjustment to it. Now, you're going to hear this all the time, DRGs, DRGs. And the confusion is everybody thinks in terms of Medicare when they hear that. The Medicare system is unlike the system. The Medicare system is a peer grouping system where the payment is not based on a hospital's cost. It's based on a statistical cost. For example, when health reform was coming up nationally, our congressional delegation was having a fit about how come Florida got paid so much and Minnesota did not. That's a byproduct of having a peer grouping system where you lump them all together, you make adjustments for what you think their wage bases are and things like that. It's fairly complex. In Minnesota, we pay based on, it's old cost, but we pay based on the hospital, individual hospital's cost, and that goes back. So it's a similar system in name, but not in effect. So don't be confused with Medicare. The inpatient rates are based on 2002 cost data of the hospital. This is fairly complex how we get costs, but suffice it to say, we find exact costs of the services provided to those medical assistance people. So it reflects the hospital's cost, the services that person gets, and the utilization of the MA patients. Laws are written, the laws are designed to update that every 2 years. So right now, we in 2011, we should be based on, I believe it's 2006 data. We're not still on 2002. And that's because it's a huge cost increase every time you want to update for that inflation. That, when you create that base rate, you've created an average dollar per admission. So the average person comes in, let's say it's $5,000. Well, we all know that a birth is pretty inexpensive and a transplant is very expensive. So what you have to do then is you simply create a set of weights, cost weights, so you increase it for transplants and you decrease it from average for births. And the intent of this is always to distribute the money fairly. It avoids arguments like, you underpaid me on this particular case. Well, on another particular case, we might have overpaid you. So our intent is to put as many of those DRG weights in as we can, diagnosis weights, so that we don't get in these arguments and it targets the payment better to that individual's services. The hospitals like it, we like it, everybody. We don't even get complaints about individual cases anymore. All it does, and this is important, so you have a per-admission payment with a diagnosis, it just cuts the pie. A diagnosis, a DRG, only cuts the pie into pieces. The best example I have is a number of years ago, a physician that did kids' cochlear implants. He called and he said, you know, I'd really like you to have a kid DRG, a kid diagnosis, because they're more expensive than adult ones. And the management is giving me a hard time because it looks like I'm losing money on every surgery I do for the kid. So we created a diagnosis group for kids. And this physician got to keep doing the cochlear implants for the kids because his payments went up, and the physicians that were running the adult cochlear implants, their payments went down. And it was fairer. It was much more fair. We just hadn't thought of it, and the doctor thought of it, and we thought this is great. So this happens all the time. We've also done it with kids' mental health and many things. The better we can target the payments, the happier everybody is. People are always complaining about a hospital-specific cost system as opposed to the Medicare DRG system as being inflationary. But the fact is, when you pay a per-admission payment, there's a lot of incentive alone to manage the stay. DRGs and this type of system has been around since 1983. They get to manage the cost. They don't. In very old days, they were brought in on Sundays for a surgery on Monday, and then they get 2 days of payment. Now they would never even consider doing something like that. But what's nice about a hospital-specific payment system, whether the policy is good or not, I mean, that's for you all to decide, it automatically adjusts for salaries, medical education costs. It adjusts for all kinds of things without going into the statistical averaging that Medicare uses. We could certainly do that if it was necessary. It would be some effort, but it can be done. You can move medical education. In the metro area, there's a lot of medical education just built into the rates. That's a whole other discussion. So the system is designed to pay a rate that is based on the old two. It's designed to pay a certain amount so that proportionally all hospitals are hurt the same amount, I would say. Because it's based on O2, and there's nothing special about long-term hospitals. This past year were allowed to be rebased, but nobody else has been. The system is also designed to maximize every piece of federal money we can, and that is the Medicare upper payment limits and the disproportional share payments, which we'll talk about later. Very quickly, then what you have is you have some add-ons to the payments. All greater Minnesota hospitals get either a 15 or 20% increase in their payments. This was done back in 1987 for the senator from Brainerd, Senator Samuelson, because the small ones had trouble with the high volume. It was very inexpensive. I remember at the time it was $25,000 each percentage point. We also pay a disproportionate share, which in legislation is called disproportionate population adjustment. I've given up the battle that DISH is a federal term and DPA is a state term. Everything's DISH now as far as I'm concerned. And that varies based on the amount of business a hospital does, inpatient business, with medical assistance. It's an add-on to reward more medical assistance business. So, and you do have a handout as part of the disproportionate share that lists what they are. Children's hospitals are 60% medical assistance for inpatient purposes. So every time a dollar is cut, they, of course, are hit disproportionately harder. But the fact is they are also have a disproportionate share add-on. I think it adds up to about $60 million a year. There's also an increase for 16 DRGs, which goes back to a huge discussion about greater Minnesota versus metro rates, and somebody's being hurt. And that went through for 16 DRGs. 30 of them get it. 81 get, 31 do not get it. And they get up to 90% of the metro average. So in effect, many of the greater Minnesota hospitals get more than the metro hospitals do, because obviously 90% of the average, there's the ones in the metro that are below the average. So we have a number out there that are getting more. Now, as far as limits go, there's a limit built on births, and that's just, I don't know exactly why it's there, because we have no other specific limits on births, but there's one in there. The aspect that is the way money has been saved over the years, it would inflate every 2 years. We would rebase between all those years. We would inflate. That was all taken out. The inflation was taken out in 2002. They haven't been rebased. Rebasing means that you go to another year of their cost data and you use that. So obviously, all a hospital's inflation is built in. So 2002 to jump to 2006, which is what we would be in effect now, would be 4 years. Well, under the forecast, that was almost a 30% increase. That's huge amounts of money, $200 million, huge amounts of money, $200 with federal share. In 13, we're supposed to have a six-year increase. We would go from 2002 to 2008, and that, I think, we're projecting somewhere in the 45 to 50% range. Historically, this never occurred as an issue, because when we inflated between the years, the money was already spent. So when you rebased them, you were just reshuffling the deck pretty much to the hospitals based on their costs, but the inflation was paid for. And as the problem gets to be as it rolls forward, it gets very, very hard to ever buy it back. And it's also in statute, so that it has to be directly taken away from hospitals. I mean, it takes a law change to not give it to them. And that's not always easy for committees to do. But it's been done all the time. We also have two payments that involve getting federal shares on various payments. One is we maximize the Medicare upper limit. It goes to two hospitals. This has been around for a while. Prior to last year, it went to 12 hospitals. Last year's statute changed to going to two hospitals. There is no budget effect. It's just all federal money, but it maximizes the limit. There was also a quarterly payment in previous years that was about $30 million a year that no longer exists for hospitals. Oh, that went away. We have another called a certified public expenditure. These things are very difficult. It gets federal money without a state share. I mean, with a state share that the hospitals give to us. It has no budgetary, in fact, would be the best way to say it. And that maximizes out the DSH payment. So everything is designed to be maxed out to get as much federal money as we can. It's all designed, whether it gets it or not. Some of it's difficult to get because of various limits. Then there are the ratable reductions. Ratable reductions is a term that always hits your word processor. Is ratable, what is it? Ratable reduction is just a percentage cut. It's a discount. And currently, as has been said, it's at 14.4%. So we figure out how much we would have owed you under the law, and then we take 14.4% off. In practice, it's actually about 1% lower, because you take less from a less from a less, so it's actually a little lower. And in 12, it's going to be 16.25%. Now, interestingly, on mental health, they're excluded, which is about 15% of the cost. So currently, they have a 1.5, mental health does. It was a policy decision. They have a 1.5% reduction compared to the 14.4. And they will have a 3.46 compared to the 16.25. So mental health for inpatient services isn't really impacted by the ratables as much. So essentially, that's just a broad overview from the write-up I have. And you know, it's a fairly good system that I would say most people would believe could use some money in better times.
Thank you very much, Mr. Olson. Appreciate your presentation and what you've given. I have one couple questions for you. Have any hospitals closed in the last year or two?
I'm sure, I don't know exactly if any of them have closed. They've been closing for years and years. I mean, I remember when Comfrey Hospital, they made the cover of Smithsonian Magazine for having five beds. All those hospitals along the highway north of I-90, every town had a hospital. Mountain Lake, all those, they're gone. medical assistance is usually not a big determining factor in any. I mean, we run a lot of business through children's and things like that, but you can look from the disproportionate share piece that they're not making a lot of decisions based on medical assistance. Medicare is a big buyer for them, and I'm sure that's it. But I don't know of any that have specifically closed. It's not like the nursing home issue where they're 100% reliant upon us or you know, under the old equal pay and stuff. But I think that, you know, you all, anybody that's from Greater Minnesota knows this much better than I do. It's like losing a school or something. You know, it's just.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
We have 135 hospitals, I believe. And that's been pretty stable.
I appreciate that. I know there was a period of time where we did have so many of those, and we've gone through that kind of process, but I was just curious as to the last little while. And they've also become more diversified and broader, and so they aren't as dependent upon being a standalone hospital only because of the combinations that they've come into. So I was just curious if there are any, and I'm sure Ms. Krinke would be able to probably have those numbers very, very handy. I know that you're also, Mason. Mr. Mason is also here, and I understand that he's mainly here if there were any questions as well under the rates policy specialist. But I would just open it up if there are any questions from members, in particular in regards to payments or rates. If not, we would go ahead and proceed. I think, Mr. Olson, you are on deck again, maybe, or does Mr. Mason have something to present in particular?
Mr. Mason is going to present the RBRVS, and then I was going
to... I think we have a few minutes to do so, or... 1 minute. Okay, yes, yeah. We have... Please, welcome Mr. Mason.
Madam Chairman, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Steve Mason with the Department of Human Services. I work in the Health Services and Medical Management Division. I have a handout. It is labeled RBRVS Overview, just a two-pager. I think I'm listed on the agenda as talking about hospital services, and this isn't actually about hospital. It's about a methodology that we're using to pay for professional services. And I guess these services could be provided in the hospital, but it really isn't the payments to the hospital. It's not facility fees. It's a methodology that we use for paying professional services. So I'll a little background first, I guess. Well, in the division I work in, we apply the payment rates for a variety of services, these professional services, other things like lab services or medical supplies, so a variety of different kinds of things. There is no, federal law doesn't specify any particular method, just that the methods used by Medicaid agencies are reasonable and that the payments are adequate. The federal agencies, CMS, Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, require that we propose methods for paying the services that we cover, and they must approve those methods in order for us to use them. In state law, the duties of the commissioner of the department are to determine which services are covered under medical assistance and what the payment rates will be. We use the payment rates for Medicare or for Medicaid, excuse me, for Medicaid or medical assistance in Minnesota are also used to pay the other Minnesota health care programs. So these rates are used for Minnesota care and were used for general assistance medical care. So in statute, there are also more specific methods for different groupings of services, and that's what this is one of them, RBRVS, or resource-based relative value scale, is in statute and is used to apply this methodology to a variety of professional services. So the kinds of services we're talking about here, physician services provided by chiropractors, physical therapists, occupational therapists, radiology services. It's not a methodology for some of those other things. It's not for medical supplies or lab services, or it's not for anesthesia. So this methodology went into effect for service dates beginning 1/1/11. It replaced a methodology that was based on providers submitted charges. Through 12/31/10, we were using that methodology. The old methodology paid at roughly the median submitted charge of services provided in 1989. So this new methodology was plugged in on a cost-neutral basis. And the handout shows how it works. It really is just a valuation system that's a national standard used by Medicare, used by other payers. It assigns a value to each procedure code composed of, there's a physician work element, a practice expense element, and a malpractice expense element. And those three things are combined and then multiplied by what is called a conversion factor to determine a payment rate. So all of the services that we paid were revalued according to this RBRVS valuation system, and then conversion factors were applied. We actually used three different conversion factors for three different groupings of service within these professional services. So we dialed in those conversion factors so that the payments under RBRVS will be budget neutral. In aggregate, we should pay the same as we did under the old submitted charge-based methodology. There's a conversion factor for most services. There's a second conversion factor for physician visits, which are the most often provided service by primary care practitioners. And we have a third conversion factor just for mental health services. So included in this methodology are a lot of the mental health services. So there's a separate conversion factor for mental health so that we could maintain the rates at what they currently pay. So the methodology really sets the base rate that we pay for these kinds of professional services. And then to those base rates, we apply the add-ons and cutbacks that have been legislated over previous years. So the rate reductions that went into effect in 2009 and last year are still applied because they're a law, so we that still is part of the payment process and the payment calculation. I guess a nice feature of RBRVS is the valuation process is recognized nationally. It seems to turn out to be more realistic than the old submitted charge-based methodology. Especially over time, it seemed like some of the services, the more physician technical services like MRIs, maybe 20 years ago, were so much more highly valued in comparison to other things than they are now. So it seemed we were paying more for certain technical or certain surgical services under the old methodology, and this method puts the payment rates valued in relation to each other. So it seems a methodology that's more agreeable to providers and to the medical societies. One other nice feature of this is the conversion factors that are applied to determine the rate can be used as a means to increase or decrease the payment rates. In an ideal world, we could have a more straightforward RBRVS system and use those conversion factors for that purpose, and it would make our fee schedule more transparent. Providers are familiar with this methodology, and you know anyone is able to look at the CMS RBRVS valuations for each procedure, and then it's a matter of just saying, and our conversion factor is this, and it's easier then to figure out what the payment rate should be, because we also apply those other add-ons and cutbacks. It gets a little murky. You know, the things that we've done for rate reductions are conditional. A rate reduction might apply for one type of physician and not to the other. So, there are reasons why we did things that way, but a lot of us are in favor of is something that's transparent. I mean, we do hear that from the feds, that it's important to make it more clear what your payment rates are. So, but that's really all I had, was just for your information. This is a new methodology that we're using. It is budget neutral, and we expect then we would be adjusting these conversion factors each year so that it remains budget neutral unless we're told differently.
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, Madam Chair. Mr. Masson, thanks for coming. I feel like I'm in actuary school a little bit here. I know you've been working toward this for some time, and now here we are on the cusp of this. How are these? And there was an old system where people submitted charges based upon what they thought their own expenses were and their value and their malpractice and all that. Can you comment on how these compare with charges historically, and also who the winners and losers are on this? Because they're going to get a hold of us, though. The winners aren't, but the losers are. They're going to let us know.
Yeah. Mr. Chair, that you would expect a submitted charge valuation system should come out to be similar to this, and it was similar. I think that it, over time, because we were still using a valuation that was set on 1989 charges, it got to be a little obsolete. You know, perhaps we could have used a more current base year and use submitted charges. It seemed like RBRVS was used by a lot of payers and seemed to be something favorable in the provider community. As far as winners and losers, I know that certain of those technical kinds of things, like I mentioned, like radiology, those rates went down. On the other hand, one of the things that we were already applying to our payment rates due to legislation last session was that we could pay no more than the Medicare rate. So we already were paying no more than Medicare's allowed amount for those radiology services. This methodology is based on what Medicare pays, and in aggregate, we pay less than Medicare, so pretty much all our rates are now lower. I think primary care was probably, or at least the physician visits were a winner. Offhand, I don't really know in other categories which were winners and losers. I know we did make sure that mental health was maintained at, you know, close to what it was paid under the old system. Most of their services had slight rate increases. A few went down, but it is based on a valuation within that group of services. So, if you want more information on that, winners or losers, we could look into that.
And Madam Chair, just to follow up.
Yes.
Is there some kind of a CPT list of? I mean, is that, it's more detailed than anybody else wants by? But I'd be interested to look at it if there's an online list or something.
Yeah, we're working to get the fee schedule online by the 15th.
Okay. Thank
and
you.
There may be a spreadsheet or something available too. We've kind of frantically been working to get it ready to go for the first.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Masson, and I think that that additional information would be very welcomed. And if you send it out to the committee administrator of this committee, we'll see to it gets out to the rest of the members. All right, to make it more convenient for you. And we have a couple questions to your Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Masson, roughly what percentage of total expense is due to malpractice? And has that gone up or down over the years?
Madam Chair and Representative, the percentage for the malpractice portion is, I think, around 4%.
Thank you, Mr. Masson. Does that conclude your question, Representative Hamilton?
And, Madam Chair, I was just wondering what the trend has been, if that's been going up or down over the years, if we knew that.
Mr. Masson, do you have that's a secondary question?
Madam Chair, Representative, I think it's been roughly the same the last few years. I don't know that that portion has changed much. I know at least just for the last few years it hasn't, but I haven't really tuned into RBRBS that we've needed to. So,
thank you,
Mr. Masson. If you have any additional information in regards to that part of that formula, if you might have some other additional information, if you could again forward it to our committee administrator, we'll get it out to the members. All right. And we have another question for you from Representative McDonald.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. Mr. Masson, I appreciate your data here and the methodology of how to establish the physician's time and technical skill and the cost of it, but the question that I've had for quite some time since running and speaking with my hospital in my district and my doctor since I was a wee lad is that the great work that he and his staff do is great. However, they are paid barely 70 cents on the dollar for the work that they do based upon our state programs. So I appreciate the information in front of us, but are you the person to ask, or can you give us the answer of how is it that our doctors and our facilities and hospitals are not paid the full price of their quality care? And that's the question that I have for you.
Mr. Masson?
Madam Chair, Representative McDonald, we're restricted to pay just what money we have in the budget. This methodology may redistribute the money by the valuation system that we're using, but I guess we're not in the position to increase the rates unless it is decided by the legislature.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Representative McDonald, yes.
Yeah, I hope that, and I believe, Mr. Hibbler, that we are going to, that's one of the areas that we're going to hopefully reform and see to it that our doctors and our hospitals are paid their fair share for the quality of work that they do. I don't think it's fair or equitable or sustainable that they should continue to operate at a loss. I know as a private business person myself, if I had to do business with the state and they gave me 70 cents on the dollar product that I offer, I could not be in business. And I think we're going to look at it. I think that's why we're here, obviously, and I'm anxious and excited to dive into that. But I've yet to hear why that is the reason. I've yet to hear the cost of that and why that's the reason.
Thank you, Mr. McDonald, Representative McDonald, for your comments. And Mr. Masson, again, any additional information, and I'm sure that Chair Abler in his conversations with us, that's exactly why, and it's a good committee for you to be a member on, because that is part of what we do here. So it's a very good committee, and you'll be able to have an influence on that future and that process here and on the floor as well. But I do know that we just have a few minutes left, and Mr. Chairman, do you want to do the... Any more questions? Otherwise, I know we had one more presenter, but Mr. Chairman, I don't know what.
Well, I think that maybe I'll go back
here.
Yeah,
go ahead.
Thank you, Representative Kiffman. There's a dish handout there, and I don't know what level of detail to go into at these kinds of meetings on these kind of matters. I think you could spend. Thank you for the department for coming. I think if you read over the handout and if people decide that they would like more testimony about this, we can go into more detail about DISH. And maybe the work groups can have some more content about that. I'm afraid I'm swimming some of you away on some of this matters. We do have minutes. Anybody like to?
So moved, Mr. Chair.
Oh, sorry. You got me. Oh, yeah. Do you have a question about the minutes?
Yes, I do.
For the minutes.
Mr. Chair, I have a correction.
Oh, a correction. Please.
My name doesn't have a C in it, my last name. So I wondered if we could delete that.
There being a motion to delete the C, anyway. Yeah, the staff will address that. Thanks for reading the minutes. Actually, you could have moved them having read them. Anyway, any other corrections to the minutes? And I just want to point out that...
it's true.
If you're not going to be here, please make sure you tell Andy Lear, and then he'll excuse you. to the minutes. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Thank you for that. And I just, we've been, I think this has been a productive hearing on this topic and plan for more of these. There's, I think we're going to have 8 little work groups, just so you can start thinking about that. Waivers, welfare, long-term care, health care, child care, hospitals, mental health, and chemical dependency. And I chatted with that about Representative Liebling in Tom's absence. So you can talk about that internally and see how you want to participate there. Our caucus is meeting at 4:30, and we'll talk about those there. Representative Hash.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just looking at today's committee's schedule, one of the things we didn't cover was the committee rules. Are we going to do an overview of those at the next committee?
I did that at the beginning. I said, if you have any questions, let me know. Do you have any questions offhand about those?
Mr. Chair, I do have a question on the rules, and I just wanted to kind of understand the precedence when with the ability for the chair to rule germaneness on issues. I don't recall any committees having that in the rules, and just kind of wanted to get your thoughts or the background of where that came from.
Well, I think that has been ruled on at various times in the past. It's a personal thing, actually. I've sat in Ways and Means Committee and watched them on TV while they brought in some just totally abstract things that weren't the least bit relevant. That's all, and I don't plan to be a jerk about it. So I just thought I'd write it in there, give it a suggestion to make it better. Yeah.
Mr. Chair, our House rules allow require that amendments be within the jurisdiction of a committee, but jurisdictional issues are much broader than germaneness. And actually, Mason's, to my understanding, allows for a wider breadth within committee structure and committee activity, and that germaneness ruling shouldn't be ruled by the chair, but by the body.
Well, let's talk about it offline.
Okay.
I mean, I think if you know my nature, it's not going to be to, if you're concerned that something you would bring up would be, we're going to have like speaker rulings on germaneness that favor one side or the other, I don't think we're going to go there. I just, it wasn't meant to be anything very fancy. Rep. Stanislav?
Yeah, I had a question about 3B. The second part, I'm not familiar with that either. I haven't seen that done. The taking role upon a reconvening, is that something new, or I haven't really seen that?
Well, I just thought I'd put that in there to encourage people to come. If we're going to come back, we're not going to have a lot of recesses and come back. I think if we come back much, it's going to be like at 4:30 on Tuesdays, right at the end of the policy thing. And sometimes an entire bank of people are gone, and I just kind of encourage people to show up. And I think that it would be within the chair's prerogative to request a noting of who's present anyway. I'm just kind of giving people notice. I don't think we're going to do it much. I just wanted to mention that please participate. That's the intention of it.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The only thing is that if we know we can't come back, some of us, if there's a kid's school activity or something, the meeting's going longer, we're going to reconvene. Do we just let the committee administrator know then that we're not able to come back?
Right, and then you'd be excused. Yeah. And it's just to, we have a ton of work to do. And so it's meant to be moving us to our productive outcome. And so if anybody feels I've been not, it's too early to criticize how I've been. I think I've been pretty good so far. But if later you sense that I've been, there's still time. But if there's a sense that I've been unfair, please take that to me either publicly or privately, and we'll try to address it. And at some point, we'll have to decide how to conduct ourselves. And so if you have specific things about how to write it better, this is meant to be a draft for people's input. And we are, we have divergent views from, each caucus has divergent views within its own membership on how to do things. So my goal is to be productive and focus on the mission. And so if you can say it more cleanly to get us toward that, that's what those rules are for. So Representative Hash and others. So. Any other discussion about that? So we're not really going to vote on these. They're just kind of announced, and then I'll redraft them based upon how you persuade me. So, anyway, that and so we're meeting Thursday. Tomorrow is the One Minnesota at the Humphrey Center. Please go. You will be enlightened and get to meet some good new people. With that, we're adjourned. Thank you.